All right, let's reconvene. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Now, this is Wayana Residents Association.
Yes, Wayana Residents Association. So here's a set of legal provisions and cases. Commissioner, I've got my two witnesses here, and if you have questions of me, that's actually here, that's the person, for example, asking Mr. Hunt, if you leave, I'll get them to assist.
Yes, no, that's fine, thank you very much.
Right. So I'll just start off with paragraph 2 of the legal submissions. The designated district sits within the wider Middle East Reserve, and it's located near the rural lifestyle settlements of the Waiwa Reserve, the Blanket Bay Rural Visitor Special Zone and the Township of Glenorchy. As such, the effects of its treatment environment is managed to a level that is consistent with sustainable management. For the purpose and needs of the use of the designation as an airstrip, the notified boundary of the designation is appropriate. In terms of the power sought to be exercised by the requiring authority, there is no justification for extending the boundary wider, and the Residents Association strongly opposed the change. And just, I'll pick up on there because I don't actually address that in any detail further. The conversation we had with my friend this morning about buildings, for example, and extension of the boundaries that would therefore extend the footprint to enable buildings. One point to also bear in mind is that this land is an outstanding natural landscape classification area on the planning map. So, in my submission, it would seem inappropriate to permit buildings within the O&L through this process without any assessment of the effects of any new development of that scale. It's much more appropriate that any new buildings require resource consent under the O&L provisions of the plan. Paragraph 2.3. Historically, there have been no controls on the intensity of use or noise generated by use of the airstrip. And the recently approved civil fuel reserve management plan that we've already talked about is intended to impose some controls on the intensity of use but has no jurisdiction for controlling adverse effects such as noise beyond the boundary of the reserve. Approving the designation in its current form with no control of the intensity of activity or noise effects will not provide for sustainable management and will not meet the test in Part 8 yet. And again, I'm just going to extrapolate from there and touch only very briefly on the issue of scope. So there's, as the conversation occurred this morning on the question of scope arising from the Wayna submission, I looked again at the Chapter 37 as notified. This designation was notified as a recreation zoo, and there are default conditions in Chapter 37 for recreation reserves that include controls on noise.
And where do I find them?
So they are, well, it's at the end of Chapter 37 under the heading G. Sorry, it was notified as G. Notified as G recreation reserve, and then there's a set of default recreation reserve conditions if the specific recreation reserve doesn't have its bespoke recreation reserve conditions, which some of them do. So it was notified as a recreation reserve, that was what was in the notified version. Section G sets out the default recreation reserve provisions, which include paragraph 9 noise. So that's on page 103 of Chapter 37. So that was it as notified, which I have to admit we possibly overlooked in the preparation of our evidence.
And what does it actually say in that?
Activities other than outdoor recreation shall be conducted such that the following noise levels are not exceeded at the boundary of the site. All zones except rural, rural zones during daytime 55 dB LAEQ, 15 minutes. During nighttime 40 dB LAEQ, 15 minutes. So here's the actual puzzle for scope, that's your starting point in my submission. And then when if you are concerned about scope, if you look at the actual submission of Wauna, it's very clear that noise is an issue that the submitter wants controlled. And whilst there was specific relief sought, there was also the fallback position of any other consequential or other relief that this would have to the submitter's concerns clause. So if you were to be considering imposing an actual noise standard or a noise limit, it's scope not only from the notified version of the recreation reserve conditions, but also the general group, the general plea for relief that addresses the issues raised in the submission. Yes, approving the designation in its current form with no control of the intensity of activity or noise effects will not provide for the sustainable management and will not be protected by the Act. So the Residents Association has provided a solution and evidence to achieve a flexible and pragmatic approach to management of the effects of the use of the airstrip. This approach is based upon expert evidence and is consistent with the remainder of the proposed district plan and the purpose of the Act. And in summary, this is what's presented to Mr. Ferguson, the evidence. We seek that the designation contain provisions that clarify and provide certainty as to the exact purpose of the designation, restrict buildings, control hours of operation, require users to follow the Fly Navy guidelines, and require development of and compliance with the noise management plan that achieves the noise limit LDN 55 at dwellings from aircraft activities associated with the aircraft. So the next point I touched on is this jurisdiction control as it affects aircraft noise under designation. Evidence of Ms. Galavazi for the required authority states in her paragraph 8.45 when she's discussing the recommendation to impose the flying and their guidelines that while it is unclear whether it is possible to control noise from aircraft once they've departed from the runway through the designation, I consider that this is an appropriate condition that seeks to address noise effects of aircraft taking off from the airstrip when they are climbing through the airspace and will ensure that operators are considerate of the residents of the area. In my submission, the jurisdiction of the RMA to control aircraft noise and operations comes from the following. Section 31, the territorial authority has the primary responsibility for managing effects of land use and noise. And this includes effects on amenity values. Local authorities obviously have the expertise in dealing with environmental management issues and noise pollution. And under the RMA, territorial authorities can make rules to control noise emissions from airports, including takeoff and landing. And this is done, you know, the other, for the Waikato Airport and the Queenstown Airport, there's, you know, very comprehensive controls over noise of the aircraft in the air as they approach and leave the airport. This is obviously different from controlling noise from general aircraft that are in flight, not associated with landing, and that lever is controlled under the jurisdiction of the Civil Aviation Act. And in this plan and in other plans around the country, there's a standard to include noise management plan through the provisions of the designation. The noise management plan concept promoted through the evidence of the Residents Association is intended only to manage effects of aircraft operations associated with the airstrip itself, so that effects of the airstrip are managed to a level appropriate to the receiving environment. So the limit we've compiled based on Mr. Hunt's recommendations is LDN 55. And perhaps before I launch into this, I'd like to get Mr. Hunt to give us a two-sentence summary of what LDN 55 actually means.
Okay. Yes, that's fine. But actually, also goes to the rule that you pointed to, as the notified rule for activities in the area. The proposed plan requires the limits to be measured and assessed in accordance with two relevant New Zealand standards. One is the measurement standards of 801, and the other one is the assessment standard 602. So any land use rule in the plan for compliance assessment purposes runs with these two standards. I think there's the analysis in the noise chapter. And 602, the assessment standard is important in this case because it says that these types of 15-minute short duration noise assessment need to be done more appropriately for assessing noise and transportation noise, and refers the user to the relevant standards. And in this case, I guess it would talk in general terms about NZS 805, which is termed Airport Noise Management and Land Use Planning. And a similar standard according to NZS 607 that deals with helicopter noise in a similar manner. Both of those aviation-focused system standards measure and assess aircraft noise using LVN. So it is, in layman's terms, an average amount of noise for a day, and it's made up by the contributions of individual aircraft to noise events, mainly contained or cumulatively. And it always applies at a point in space, you know, someone's outdoor receiving environment. In this case, we're talking about the closest designated building platform in the subdivision, is where, in essence, that LVN 55 would apply. It would apply to all buildings, but obviously it's the closest one, it's my position. So the standards of K05, I'll just talk about it later. I'm not advocating we take that whole methodology, which is designed for quite big airports, and apply that to the future, but there are some elements that key one of the cases, the way we measure noise over a whole day, made up of contributions of students during the day, and although not relevant here, there's a penalty that would apply to any movements occurring at night time, but it just doesn't rise in this case with the proposed house restrictions. So it just becomes daily at average star level, and it's made up of the contribution from movements throughout the day.
Okay. So Mr. Hunt said that this is that the hyena preserves in the receiving residential environments is a high energy natural noise environment. And he recommends that if Andrew protects some residents and visitors to the area after being managed to an appropriate level, the level of LVN 55, of course, with national and international expectations, suitable levels of noise nuisance emanating from airports and airstrips. And while that level will still compromise energy values of residents, and that's an important point to note, so I think both Mr. Hunt and Mr. Charles are in agreement that there will be a level of adverse effect still associated with LVN 55. The residents are proposing it in recognition of the existing use and operations of the airstrip in an attempt to find an appropriate balance. For these reasons, the imposition of the LVN 55 standard will, in combination with other measures, help achieve sustainable management of the airstrip resource by managing the youth development and protection of natural physical resources and enabling the community, both commercial operators and residents, to provide for their social, economic and cultural well-being. And this standard is also consistent with wider provisions of the proposed strict plan relating to fixed aircraft and with recreation reserve provisions. The Residents Association proposed a mechanism by which the noise limit together affects the noise management plan, which can be reviewed and adapted in order to respond to changing circumstances. What is the relevance of the baseline data or lack thereof? All experts agree that there is uncertainty as to the baseline use levels of the aircraft. However, in my submission, this is not relevant to consideration of the management of adverse effects. We know what the receiving environment is, and we need good evidence of inappropriate noise level that aircraft activities should be managed to in order to address adverse effects on that receiving environment. Baseline data use levels is not relevant to that assessment. Despite this, the 42A report in particular states that there is not sufficient baseline information regarding the current nature and scale of commercial activities utilising the airstrip in order to impose conditions relating to the frequency of flight, noise limits, etc. With respect to council as acquiring authority, the fact there is no ownership, accountability and responsibility exercised for monitoring the use of the reserve is not an appropriate justification for now not imposed formal noise and use controls. Council has had control over the reserve as administrative authority, just in hang on, under the Reserve Act for over 3 years now, and its decision earlier this year on the management plan provides that use is generally to be maintained at the level which exists at the time the plan became operative. This is a positive first step in the management of the reserve. Current operators are not acting under authorisation of leases or licence agreements. At the time of writing these submissions, there are no such agreements in place for the aircraft. So, in my submission, contrary to my agreement, the concept of a permitted baseline has limited relevance to your decision on the designation and the district plan review process. There is no justification to refrain from imposing the restrictions and the designation on the basis that there is no baseline data for existing operations. Previous lack of management of adverse effects cannot justify ongoing lack of management of those adverse effects. What is justified is to impose noise restrictions based upon the evidence. The relevance of the Reserve Act. The management plan is implemented pursuant to the Reserve Act, which provides jurisdiction to manage the use of the reserve for the benefit of the reserve. So it's particularly inward looking, all about the reserve. And once you set out there the description of recreation reserve as per the Reserve Act. Leasing and licensing processes under the Reserve Act restrict the assessment of effects to those on the reserve lead only, and are not for the purpose of mitigating adverse effects on persons in nearby receiving environments. The evidence of drop controls, so Andrew Scalabardi also states that there is no technical reason why due to this, or additional controls on flight numbers and noise levels should be imposed as designation conditions, given that the Reserve Management Plan provides this control. Even if there is no technical reason to impose such controls, the practical and lawful reasons are simple and are set out below. The Reserve Management Plan does not provide any hard limits in terms of limited operators, flight numbers and noise limits. It provides no specific guidance for determining appropriate concessions and licenses in regard to a specific baseline or requirement capacity or a cap. And while the narrative objective is to keep the nature, scale and intensity of use of the airstrip limited to the level that existed at the time the plan was adopted this year, that level of use is not described in a more helpful narrative way or quantified. It is uncertain. So in light of these factors, the effectiveness of the reserve management plan at managing the scale and use of the airstrip is still uncertain. Adverse effects arising from the use of the airstrip therefore need to be managed in the RMA framework, as they will not be managed directly as standard through the reserve management plan. Furthermore, the now expressed preference of council to transfer management of certain acceptable levels of use of noise nuisance to the reserve management plan process contradicts council's earlier position in the hearing for the reserve management plan that the designation of the proposed district plan was the appropriate mechanism to control noise effects. And this has also been discussed with us further in the letter. So we're just very concerned that the noise issue is going to fall through the act. It was effectively deferred in the reserve management plan process by the council to this process, but now it feels like it's being banded back again. Your decision is subject to part 2, or your recommendation, I should say, and I should set out a relevant section from the Ardmore Airfield tenant's case, which I won't read out now. And note 7.2, that the Supreme Court can stand and judgment in subsequent decisions of the courts have not changed the approach of designation decisions being explicitly subject to the judging exercise and subject to Part 2. The High Court, most recently in the New Zealand NPCA, distinguishing them and confirmed the Board's approach to Part 2 under Section 171 as being subject to Part 2. So you must therefore, in my submission, consider what will be the best method for the proposed designation to provide for sustainable management. Allowing unfettered use and noise nuisance by not imposing controls through a noise management scheme will compromise the energy advantage of the received environments. It will compromise the quality of the rural and rural living environments, which is a particularly pristine and desirable place to live and visit for its rural and energy quietness, and will not provide the finite nature of that type of rural resource. A decision to not implement any noise management plan controls through the designation will be inconsistent and non-permission with Section 17 of the Act. And whilst unfettered commercial operation using the airstrip would provide an economic efficiency in terms of Section 17 of the Act, this must also be considered in light of the adverse effect. Having regard to the rural locality, including the way in its reserve, the most efficient use of the airstrip resource would be to provide an appropriate and reasonable level of control that allows the airstrip to continue to operate in accordance with the low-scale purpose of the airstrip, and which does not undermine the energy values of the receiving environments. In conclusion, in order to meet the requisite test for my submission, the adverse noise effects of activities associated with the designation need to be controlled to an appropriate level. The Residents Association proposed a package of controls, including a noise limit, to be implemented for a management plan framework. The alternative approach would have been to prescribe specific takeoff and landing limits, flight paths and types of aircraft, etc., or within the designation itself, which is not a terribly flexible approach. The provisions proposed under the Ferguson in Section 11 of the evidence also state that it recommends that the noise management plan include a method of review and the implementation of the scheme ultimately be voted by council as regulatory authority. And these provisions provide an appropriate balance between certainty for residents in the community as to acceptable levels of noise immunity and flexibility for operators and stakeholders to agree on the methods to achieve that outcome through consultation and community planning.
Alright, thank you. In the legal submissions for Skydive Queensland Limited, there were quite some, if you like, direct attacks in terms of the issue of scope. Now, you've covered them in a general sense.
Mm.
Is there anything further you want to add?
No, I think I could address it really quickly in writing so that you get out my arguments clearly, which I could do today, I'm able to get something to before we help the today, so that you could see why we agree that there is no scope for the relief that we're now currently proposing. But it has really been recently raised in our submission, and the issues that were set out in the submission that we have, and in the general plea for relief at the end of the submission, along in combination with the version of the designation Recreation Reserve Commission being notified. So I will set
that
out just so that you've got that.
Yeah, because there are some quite discreet issues that are raised in McDonald's submission about the issue of scope of the Waiuna submission.
Yeah.
And I'd prefer to have them covered in a more direct way rather than sort of, you know, the kind of blanket approach that you've given me verbally.
Yeah. Not very
happy to do that. Because some of those members could prove to be, I don't know at the moment, but they could prove to be quite important. That McDonald's raised in relation to that.
Is
by then,
are they sufficiently?
Well,
it's sufficient.
You can take until this hearing remains open through till Friday and beyond.
Okay.
So I wouldn't rush by Friday, would be fine.
Okay, thank you.
The issue of the lack of data. The lack of understanding about nature of current noise levels and matters of that sort. Isn't that sort of critical whatever way we go? Through your submissions and evidence, you're proposing a noise level to regulate activities going forward. But we don't know anything about existing noise levels.
We don't.
So
in the technical sense, we don't. We know what the residents are saying, which is that two noises don't like it, but that's all we know.
I understand that, comes through loud and clear, I'm afraid. But apart from that, let me drill down into that. Do you think that there's a permitted baseline argument that's available to the users of the Eurodrome?
Well, I haven't looked at the legal case that I've been referred to, so I'd really have to have another read of that. Because I was of the view that permitted baseline was mainly section 104 matter of discretion, if it would help to your decision.
Mm-hmm.
But because you don't know what that permitted baseline actually is here, because there's been no measurements and there's been no counting to that, it's not helpful to your decision because we don't know what it is.
But in that way, if I don't know what it is, how then can I assess the reasonableness of what Mr. Hunt is telling me to do or suggesting I do?
Well, he's probably going to try to that question in terms of where that limit has been used elsewhere for aircraft noise as a proxy or as a default position.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, do you have a position on the availability of the permitted baseline in relation to designations?
Like I said, I haven't read Beadle. I'd like to read Beadle if that's the only case where a designation decision was done with reference to a permitted baseline, but it is a bit of a confusing decision to deal with. It was considering legal consent at the same time, so I had to talk about the permitted baseline anyway. So I would like to go and have a look at Beadle before I get to it. I think that's extremely helpful.
And are you familiar with how this council in particular was dealt with in terms of proceeds, leases and licences of reserves?
Generally?
Yeah.
No.
Not. Okay.
The concession part of the Conservation Act, which is the process by which those are granted, and if it's only a license, there's no requirement for the council to publicly notify it. It's a lease.
I'm talking about leases here, I believe.
It is leases for more than 5 or 10 years, but it's mandatory public notification.
Mm-hmm. And that allows for submissions and.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And these cases that you've given me, Ken Turner, that's about helicopter noise and that.
Yes, and it was really decided to talk about the interface between the Civil Aviation Act and the RMA.
All right, and the New Zealand Warbirds Association, what's that all about?
That's, the RMA for one thing, so.
So that's about using a noise measurement in the context of
Well, it's actually primarily scientists and on the confirming that she's a national citizen for subject part two.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also heard a more management thing from the NC, which was one of our other examples.
And go to NZCO?
Yes, that's the basis for our application.
Right. Okay. Alrighty, thank you.
Thank you.
So, which witness would you go to first?
I think we just want to have Mr. Hunt before we have Mr. Ferguson do his overall.
Sure.
So, people need to read a summary. And just go straight into questions from the missionary. Right. I've got something to add.
No, I've explained what that would be, but that's probably the first technical term. So, no, I think that's
ultimately, Mr. Hunt, you land on a sort of outcome or recommendation that there'd be a condition included within the declaration to develop the noise management plan.
That's in a nutshell. I've actually summarised it a little bit atop page 3 as a pairing of two types of condition, one being a requirement for the master plan to be prepared, but I think almost more importantly, that having an information position which requires all the aircraft activity you can get to conform with that master plan. So,
okay, and the process that you've got in mind for the development of the noise management plan?
So probably the best example I can think of is in the late 90s when the airport noise emissions of the city district came in for such a tender, and she basically wrote a condition that she said that the council is responsible for getting all the parties around the table and agreeing on the following bullet point lists, which were matters that had come up during the hearing as matters of contention, but you know, obviously there wasn't enough time or possibly even willingness around the table to resolve all the issues, but she threw it back to the parties that they needed to sit down under the council's direction and not out the appropriate standards. I thought that was a brave approach, and it worked because the parties had to sit down. There was no plan B. They had to prepare that it was a condition of the destination that the airport council were very keen on convening and reconvening the necessary meetings to make that happen. But I think the other thing, what I mentioned earlier in 55, if the parties agreed to a certain level of use that turned out to be 56 and a half, I would have no problem with that. I used the 55 and the guide. I think what I think the parties need to do around that table is just look at, if we had a daily allocation of 55, how would that be used up? Because it'll be, a dozen of the quieter fixed wing, but it'll only be three or some very noisy aircraft. And I think the best way to thrash out the optimal level of use would be for them to agree around numbers and movements by different aircraft types and start thinking about the idea that the noisy aircraft is going to use up the available noise quota much quicker than wider aircraft, which you could have more of and still achieve the overall limit. So, far be it from me to stay outside and try to sort of post some numbers in there and say, look, this aircraft or that, it's something that users of the neighbourhood can work out among themselves.
Okay, now, staying with the point about the actual number, Mr. Charles, in his evidence, he talks about LDN, he talks about it being an average over a 3-month period, I think, from memory. And it's his view, at his paragraph 4.3, that he doesn't think that that's necessarily an appropriate approach.
Well, I don't believe averaging over 3 months is at all sensible. So, given my evidence, I don't wish to follow 6805, which is the approach he's described there. Well, we aren't using the term LVM, but in fact, LVM is defined in another standard. We don't even have to refer to 6805. The unit is important because it does and as a consequence of that, you have a value allocation of noise that will be used up in different ways. But yeah, I would agree with you, averaging over 90 days is completely inappropriate for the obvious trip.
Now, this is more kind of an interpretive and a legal question, but given your background, do you consider that the existing designation authorises aircraft noise when aircraft are taking off and landing from the SIP? And does it also authorise aircraft noise when the aircraft are in the air beyond the SIP?
I believe the council, the Act and Power Council, to control noise from the aircraft that are, just slightly more broader term, using the airstrip, and that the CAA guidelines talk about 500 feet flying over rural areas, and I always sort of use that as a bit of a beyond 500 feet, I think councils jurisdiction might start to thin out, and but I wouldn't, again, say it's a hard and fast rule, but it's a guy. As they get up and away and they're on their normal flight routine, obviously the council's power to control noise is evaporated. But on and in the vicinity of the air and drone or the airstrip, I believe the council does have all the designations that have the power to control noise in the aircraft.
Have you been involved in a process dealing with noise from small aerodromes such as this, where the issue of noise effects was discussed and dealt with by way of leases or licences?
I've investigated noise in Milford Aerodrome, and there are agreements that DOC has in place regarding the use of that, but of course it's a level of activity far greater than what they're talking about. There's a scheduled runway, there's a manned control tower, there's a whole lot of differences. So getting back to the rural strip, really is, this was an emerging issue, and I'd say, from my experience, which is 20 odd years, this is somewhat breaking new ground, but I guess not unexpectedly, when you've got people living in a nice environment and a relatively at times 30 years from that time.
If we think about the two alternatives that may be available here, we've got your noise management plan approach attached to a designation, or we've got an approach available under a reserve management plan, which might play out in detail in terms of a lease or a license, which might contain noise limits or noise controls, both in terms of noise outputs and flight paths and the like. Do you, from a noise perspective, do you have any preference?
A few in terms of the perception that one would be relying on council to implement matters under the Reserves Act, which with the noise management plan approach, I think the noise affected parties are more closely involved, and if the system's not quite working right, there'd be mechanisms to revisit some things and put it right. Other things, the noise management plan could be reviewed on a relatively regular basis, which I'm not sure a reserve plan could be that flexible. And I think it's just that the neighbours would be dealt with it much more arm's length under the reserve back track, and we're more just reliant on the council to do the right thing. whereas the neighbours would more participate in the active management of knowledge under the voice management plan.
Now, I think of paragraph 5.6, you detail the noise from the sky fleet tandems hand gliding and paragliding microlite. Are you aware of any particular reason why that activity occurred as it does, seemingly in close proximity to the Wauna preserve residents? Is there a reason why they undertake the activity there, or is it linked from elsewhere?
I believe it's really the hang glider towing the microlight is being used as a tow plane, and the objective is to get to the release height as quickly as possible rather than flying somewhere to do that. They would prefer to sit there, and I think that the problem about, you know, since many cases it actually turns out that the communication problem as much as there is a noise problem. And through a noise management plan, the operator will have to learn that there's some specific causes that, you know, maybe they can agree on some solution.
Well, are you aware of any reason why the activity can't be shifted away from?
I was just thinking like the efficiency, you know, like less time to climb up over the hill without overlaying the wheel. Mm-hmm. I do know that the microlights have a type of engine and blade configuration which can be a bit wag related than the average aircraft, light aircraft. And the level and the character of sound would both be reduced by increasing the buffer distance.
Okay, now the lack of data issue that we've already touched on, in terms of arriving at your kind of recommendation in terms of an LDN of 55, are you at all troubled by lack of data in terms of current activities on the site?
Well, I am, because none of you have the inflow calculations. And the noise that uses the output of a single engine light aircraft variable fixed helicopter propeller plane, which in the US they all have to meet certain noise certification, which is a special test that they do. And when I plug that number into the building side, which I estimated to be about 350 metres off what we call the center line of the aircraft. That amount of noise could result in about 55 LDN to about 13 or 14 movements. So that is a standard output for a variable pitch into mighty aircraft.
So from what you understand about the current level of movement using the aerodrome, is that likely to result in a restriction?
It is likely to, but it's a tricky thing. The mix of aircraft types using it is almost as important as how many aircraft and also if for a given mix of aircraft types, he were to double the daily movements of each one equally, change of LDN is only 3. So, an LDN number can be derived at the end of the day by working out what's an acceptable level of use and by which to get that category. And I think I've had the feedback that helicopter movements don't seem to be a problem, but if they flew off in a certain direction, they could be excluded from the calculation. So there are many ways that in the end a suitable guideline can be developed, which when calculated comes out to be a level of LD, and that's just not unreasonably high, but more importantly, for day to day technical compliance, they know there's only going to be 3 of those aircraft or enough to 5 of these, and the fear of having a mix of aircraft types and number that would equal to LD, whatever the number is. So, and I think it's also pointing out that the noisier aircraft would use up to be available quota more quickly. This has the effect of encouraging more use of the quieter types.
I understand that. What I'm concerned about is that if I were to go down the route of thinking about a noise management plan and imposing a level of noise output in the face of a lack of information, I could be severely prejudicing the current operators.
But only in the event that, so above 55 would still be an acceptable amount of noise if it related to that noise was emitted by the other doctors, their favourite option, taken by flight tracks, etc. It could in fact be justified by a LDN 65 for if there were sufficient reasons to have that much noise there. I'll use 55 as my sort of sideline, but as I say, the right amount of use turns out to be 59 or some other number. It's only a guide to the total policy. I think we should all be aware that none of the permissions should allow for more than 65 on a daily basis. We said sort of cross them to it. So I'm more interested in establishing a process than a feature.
Yes, I understand. Thank you. That's been helpful. Now, just focus on that. Now, again, I've read your evidence. So, is there anything sort of further you want to add or amend in terms of what's been given to me?
No. corrections or revisions that I've taken to the evidence just to ready to respond to any questions. I did have some involvement in the, reserve measure plan hearing. I did have a bit of listening to some of the other submissions in that forum, give evidence on certain types of aircraft operations, including the SkyTrack operation. I do have some information from that process, which I could make specific to the earlier question that was
asked.
My understanding was that it was just simply related to safety. The reason that my understanding of listening to that evidence was that they take a part that's overland that I wish the safety car into the lake. So that in the event that they had a safety issue, they were able to be able to come back to the airport relatively easily and quickly overland and not compromise the safety of either the microlight or the passenger in the hang glide.
Sure.
That was my understanding of the reason the safety car in the past they do.
I thought that would be the case. Have you been involved with the Waiuna development since its inception?
No, I have not.
Do you have any information about to be able to tell me when it was first established?
No, in short, no. I wasn't involved in either the subdivision process or the rezoning.
Sure.
My recollection is that it arrived in the district plan for the first generation review. What I can't tell you is whether that was as part of the notified plan or through a decision on the submissions. But it would be safe to say that it existed by the time the council had issued its decisions and resolved the appeals on the plan.
Which is?
The decisions were issued around 1998, and I think there was some information given to you earlier about the notification of the plan that was around 1995, that's exactly right.
So in 1998, I then want to better understand when building platforms and the like came into play. Presumably 1998 was a sort of a zoning decision, and then following that there was development by way of subdivision, and that would have led to the creation of the building platforms that Mr. Hanson has referred to. So yeah. Have we got a timing on?
I haven't researched. I don't have any information that I can tell you on the timing of when that subdivision was built. I've been out to the site and seen the established facilities in the buildings which appear to have been there for some time, but Mr. Cameron,
What I'm driving at is, I'm not sure ultimately how helpful it would be to me, but I would really like to understand levels of activity at the aerodrome at the time when Waiuna was being established, just to understand what the lie of the land was at the time.
Is that something we could provide when we were going to respond to you on the government, records of the tracks of subdivision and so on?
It is. The part that I'm missing is if possibly there's no information available about the levels of activity arising from the landing strip itself at that time. That's the part that I'm still missing.
Yes, so that was because that's when DOC was the administrative body. So DOC handed over the council in the last 3 or 4 years, I think, as an administrative body. But it's whether or not DOC kept records of the commercial use, not the recreational use. But it's certainly something we can look into.
Well, at least if I had some feel for the timing of Waiuna when it came into play. Mr. Ferguson, are there particular types of activities using particular types of planes or aircraft that cause the Iona occupants more distress than others?
From my understanding of conversations I've had with representative of Iona, that the concern seems to be most issues around one operator, to be honest, and that's the SkyTree operation of flight flights. It has been conveyed to me, and this is not through my own personal observation, that helicopters are reasonably discreet, and that has been suggested that the reason for that is, of course, that they can take off in a direction which goes straight up over the lake. So a lot depends on the flight path in which the aircraft is safe.
And the fixed wing?
I think, as it has been expressed to me, the concern has been more of the potential increase of the intensity of that activity rather than a reflection of the current activity.
Right. And Mr. Hunt made a good point about communication with noise-related issues. So what's the position on communication with this single operator? What can you tell me about that?
Well, I know that there have been conversations made directly with that operator. And I understand there's a tension that exists between his operational needs on the one hand.
This is the sort of economy and the efficiency of the operation?
Well, I think it's more about the safety, about where he has to go to be able to function. And he's not apparently able to, for whatever safety reasons, to take a flight path which can ameliorate the noise effects, particularly easily.
So your understanding, they can't fly a certain distance away and then fixed climb.
That's my understanding. But I understand those concerns have been expressed directly to the operator, and including, of course, during the course of the hearing on the reserve management plan.
Yeah. And specifically, your reasoning for preferring a noise management plan as part of the designation as distinct from dealing with the issue through the reserve management plan and licenses and measures?
Well, I think it just deals with those access of information that we don't have on site.
But don't we have that issue of which either way we go?
Well, again, this is another tension that we have in terms of obviously meeting our statutory obligations under the RMA. It occurred to me that the solution of having all the access to information to be able to undertake the modelling to provide for service couldn't occur with a limit forum, and don't have the information the operators to do that. Or if that's proceeding down a parallel path in terms of the reserve management plan. Now, despite that, I felt that there was some merit in establishing a noise level which sort of does away with, if you like, an immediate need to calculate the number of flights and establish a level of intensity, because it just gets an acceptable level of noise. So it can deal with the effects of the environment, such as inundation. It can deal with the Part 2 method and say, well, here's a standard which no one has been applied to the Part 3 plan. The noise management plan, as a mechanism or as a tool, provides the flexibility for the operator of the airport to then unwind that to be able to achieve a number of flights that get to that point of that noise standard. Acknowledging the evidence that the comments made before Mr. Hunt, that could might be some debate about what that point is. But I think it's safe to say you can have this then applied in the plan. It's based on academic research, as I understand the evidence in this house, and establishes a reasonable level of intensity.
But Mr. Hunt's not, as I understand his evidence and answers questions, he's not proposing that as a result of this process we end up with an LDM of 55. He's saying let's include a noise management plan condition in the designation, i.e. get a noise management plan developed. Right? This, you're saying something different. You're saying you think the better outcome is to put an upper limit on noise. And I'm saying back to you, well, how can I do that in the absence of information about levels of current activity? Yeah. How can I sensibly do that?
It's a difficult, I understand, appreciate the difficulties there, and I think that was just as he was talking about process control is important.
I understand.
But I think that from a pain perspective, mm-hmm. I like the appeal of having a measurable standard which the noise management plan would be designed to achieve. Otherwise, I don't know that there would be a lot of merit in having a noise management plan if it didn't have a clear standard that it was designed to try and achieve.
Yeah, I understand that, but this comes back to these issues that we've been having conversations about the current level of use in terms of the aerodrome, permitted baseline and matters of that sort. They all have to be understood before that number that you're keen on grabbing makes any sense. Would you agree with that?
Well, I certainly think it would help to understand the implications of the operators, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so then, if I put development of noise management plan as a condition of the designation,
yes.
alongside the other alternate route of reserve management plan and development of conditions and leases, what's the sort of difference between the two from your perspective? You know, we're still dealing with same issues in both boxes. Lack of information about current levels of activity, lack of information about what might be an acceptable noise level threshold.
Yeah, so I guess the reserve management plan process seems to be geared towards establishing a number of licenses or leases that are proposed to be used. So that might set up the number of people that are applying in terms of the operations of the airport who might want to use that. What I'm not confident about so much is the ability of the reserve management plan process to provide a framework for assessing noise and managing that noise effects, because it doesn't set out a process for a framework for making any decisions that have to be deployed. It's just generally trying to maintain that intensity and scale at that thing change. So I feel to me that there needs to be a noise parameter put around the airport which is dealt with the designation, and I accept and see the merit in having the numbers of people and operators being worked through perhaps through a reserve management process in order to inform that.
I'm understanding primarily from Mr. Hunt's evidence and answers from questions, whichever process is ultimately chosen or utilised, noise management plan as part of the designation, or reserve management plan process, if I can call it that, both interest groups will have to get together and talk their way through the issue. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Right. Now, I hear your concern about the resource management, the reserve management plan process, but given the fact that, if you like, the noise issue is alive and well, wouldn't you think it would be somewhat unrealistic of the council to march down that reserve management plan process and not heed the concern of residents when it got to dealing with leases and licenses?
Possibly. Yes, and it would be. Sure, would feature within their thinking. What my concern is a decision that's made under the Review Act made in specific recognition of achieving a resource management purpose, such as managing effects on the environment. And I'm not confident that is the case. So if there's a decision that has to be made in the future about exceeding the number of leases and licenses under the Reserve Act, is that going to be achieved in a way which considers the piece of the environment, or is it just going to be looking at the purpose of which the reserve is held?
Sure. So the sort of picked up from the Galloway point that the perspective on reserves is kind of inward looking, and the signal I took from that submission was, well, maybe that means that issues impacting upon the surrounding users wouldn't be taken into account.
I wouldn't say that it wouldn't be taken into account, it's just the way in which it's taken into account. I think it's important.
Okay. So, just back to the key concern, we've got the microlight concern, and then the other concern, as I read from your evidence, is really not so much with the balance of the current operators, but it's the potential for increase. Is that an appropriate way to sort of try and grasp the level of concern from the residents group?
Yes, that's better. That's probably the case, but it wasn't certain, plus points what could exist beyond the number of lights on, so it could be that there's an increase in the number of lights by the existing lights on this office.
Now, you've got detail in your evidence about the appropriate preparation of the management plan, and then you've got views about monitoring outcomes and matters of that sort. Have you given thought to who would be bearing financial responsibility for these activities?
My thought on that would be it was the requiring authority itself that would drive the process for the formulation of the management plan.
The authority here concerned doesn't seem to be particularly keen on spending time and resource.
Well, yes, I understand that, but I don't think that justifies bypassing your obligations to address the effects on the environment either. So I think there's clear requirements for both this process in terms of considering the effects of the regulation, but also the regulation itself was about addressing the effects of the activities through the regulation conditions. I think doing nothing
might be
sort of an appropriate approach.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting the council that their view of doing nothing. They prefer, seemingly on the evidence I have, the reserve management plan approach. So they're certainly not in the sense of not doing anything.
Sure.
Yes. Okay. Look, as I said, I've had a good read of your evidence a number of times, and I understand the point of the idea. So other than those brief questions, nothing further from me.
Just to make one final point that occurred to me while you were talking about the difference between using the liquor license processes under the Reserve Act and going down to the Noise Management Plan route. The other key difference between those two processes is that the Noise Management Plan will take up, be a little bit integrated one-stop shop looking at the whole noise envelope, whereas as each legal license application is considered, it's a piecemeal process, not necessarily anyone is at the table each time, and the ability to grasp the cumulative effect as each legal license is granted is easily soon than under the noise management plan approach, which would look at it as an envelope.
I would have thought though that when the council is getting to the position of thinking about issuing leases or licences, it's going to be very much aligned to this cumulative issue, and it's going to say, well, there's a finite resource here.
Well, we hope so, but there's no certainty of that, whereas there is certainty if you did it under the designation. As an Noise Management Plan, you do get that certainty that it was addressed cumulatively, and that it was involved in that one process.
Mm-hmm. All right, okay, so that's fine, thank you. So for now, you're going to come back on the issue of scope. And you're going to come back on the issue of timelines when Waiuna was developed.
Can you end the pillar by one? I'll try and see that.
I just want your view about is the baseline alive and well, is the issue that I've got before me that's really all I want.
Good.
Okay. Alright, thank you very much, all three of you.
Thank you very much.
Alright, so next on the schedule is the Remarkables Park Limited in Queenstown Park.
Thank you, sir. I'll just get my equipment in my pocket. Submission for the patents will hand up to expand all the synopsis to the reply.
And I suppose, Ms. Young, what was apparent to me was a number of points of difference on factual matters between yourself and Ms. Walsh.
Correct.
So that's fine, but if I have to go through and sort out that, I will.
Yes.
But can I say, I'd rather not.
I understand completely, sir, that the difficulty you're putting with factual assertions that I'm making, that I'm supporting, I think I can resolve a few, but still yet to this. So I'm going to the first page, so I don't think I need to go through the introduction of the submission process, the full submissions of today's date. Other than the two submissions are actually really focused for Remarkables Park as a neighbouring landowner, so the QPL submission might provide you the scope if you need it, but it's really a Remarkables Park issue. And the Remarkables Park doesn't take any issue with Sir Wayne Pepper's Tab A. Proposed modifications to designation 2 as they relate to the airport mixed use site, and if I can, that's the khaki green square down there, which is the area that's just behind the terminal.
So is that immediately below the number 230?
Correct. Yeah. So, and one of the reasons for that is that it always anticipated that there'd be commercial development in that area near the terminal. So, don't take issue with the designation being modified in relation to that square, if I can say that. But RPL does take issue and opposes the modifications to the designations for the remainder of designation 2. And also takes issue with the adjustment to the description of the inner edge under designation 4. And I appreciate some more detailed response to Ms. Walsh's submission. So 1.5, the key issues can be summarised as follows. The modifications enable a significant increase in the range of activities that can be undertaken at the airport, with almost no limitations or conditions. Now, clearly, Mr. Kyle has a different view of that, and I'll address that further, but we say that the change in terms of the range of the bulk and scale activities is significant. And the failure to identify specific areas and activity types undermine any comparison to Auckland International Airport. And item B, page 3, sir, the evaluation undertaken by the airport does not comply with requirements of section 171 because there is no proper assessment of effects because the assessment that has been undertaken is driven entirely by a flawed comparison with adjoining zoning rights and setbacks. Mr. Kyle has not considered the operative district plan and integration with adjoining zones, despite that very issue being at the forefront of the Lot 16 LR, that's significant, sir, in section 171. The operative plan, that plan, must be a matter to which you have regard, particular regard, mandatory statutory consideration. frankly, flat stones are aligned as part of the ones are in the operative plan and are not proposed to be reviewed through this process. And further to above, when considering the NOR enabling similar bulk and density of buildings, the Environment Court found that the proposal would have significant effects on RPL and could not meet Part 2 of the RMA without development of a suite of conditions addressing bulk density and landscaping. And I disagree with this bulk in that case. This is helpful, I say it's very helpful, and entirely relevant to the kind of conditions or kind of issues that the requiring authority should be thinking about if it's proposing 15 metres of height and reduce setbacks on the boundary to adjoining zones. These errors in my submission are significant and cannot be remedied by off-the-cuff oral evidence today. And I just found that, I'm not sure you'll think completely this, but I would be very concerned to hear responses or conditions being thrown out today that haven't been properly contemplated with the kind of work that sit behind a modification for designation such as this. I don't think that these errors can be fixed through answers today. RPL at 1.62 does not deny that a modern airport can incorporate a range of commercial industrial activities. The short point is that I take no issue with the McElroy decisions of the High Court of the Court of Appeal. What I say about those is they send a stark message to user and to the neighbours that a wide range of activities can occur at one airport. And even one of the bases for justifying it can be just to diversify income, to help facilitate the growth of the airport and so on. So something being connected to an ancillary in the macro world sense, it's not a great limiter at all. And in fact, the statement of intent to which Ms. Walt refers to the notice of proposed actions talks about the desire to diversify income. So I don't think, I think McElroy indicates to you, or indicates, that those words in connection with our ancillary don't do a lot to limit the commercial, industrial, retail, food and beverage that might establish under a modern airport definition. So I take no issue with those decisions, so I don't challenge them, I don't say they're wrong, or that they don't apply here. I accept that that is what the High Court and Court of Appeals said. I do talk about the Public Works Act, so no assessment of effects or consideration of effects on those decisions. The issue was about off the back of land, not in use. Coming to designation two.
But just before we move the point, leave that point, I've understood that the thrust of Ms. Volk's submission around McElroy was to be effectual. That's what an airport is, that's what it includes, that's what it means. So these things that we want to include at Queenstown are already kind of inside the bag, as it were.
Well, if they were, you would need to modify the designation.
Yeah,
I think it's an acknowledgement that they're not expressly provided for.
Well, do you think that the way that I interpret her submission is accurate? Is that what she's saying?
I think what she's saying is Queenstown is a significant resource that modern airport of these things are desirable. That's fine, I said. Maybe they are. But what are the effects on them? It's not where I have great difficulty.
I understand that point, but is she not referring to McElroy in the way in which she does to sort of say, well, look, that they really are just an expectation, part and parcel of what happens in a modern airport. So I don't have to go through this detailed assessment of effects and put it in the changes that I want, because it's already there.
Or maybe.
Well, how do you read this?
I read it, saying, look, this is what the airport does, so we have to do it.
Yeah.
But one answer to that is some do, not all do. But I accept that. That may be part of the modern airport. I don't think the fact that some airports do it, or that modern airport, obviates me to assess the effects of the introduction of these new activities that weren't provided for under the existing designation. Because they quite clearly weren't. Normally it was obviated the need to assess the impact of increase in height, to measure activity height, or reduction of setbacks. And I'll take you to the Auckland Airport later on in the submission, too, where they've actually moved away from designation providing for those activities to a precinct, a zone, spot zone. And you can only infer why that is, but the inference I draw from that is that the designation wasn't without conditions, what would be the appropriate place to deal with these activities to get these sublines, and you'll see a much more sophisticated approach.
And I think I'm going to ask you about that, because I think, more than I think, that situation replicated at Christchurch, I believe, where this particular airport zone and the range of activities that are occurring there, as you say, much more sophisticated than what was previously the case.
And I don't have, you'll have much more knowledge of Christchurch, but the Monaco, the Monaco, the old operative Monaco District Plan, and my firm with the advisors of that council, had a designation with a number of conditions about harness, demands, high air noise areas. So the illicit activities are included commercial, and the airport grew very quickly because of that. There were no conditions relating to that. Through the poor process, they put conditions in that identify spot zones, recognition that a carte blanche opportunity to build commercial anywhere, that's not sustainable, that's not good resource management practice. And I think that's almost so obvious with what I'm saying, but that's exactly what's gone before. So I'll take you to some of those provisions. It's still an enabling regime, sure, but some more consideration. So at 2.1, I was just taking you through what is proposed, and what I emphasise there is the permitted activity statement. Mm-hmm. The permitted activity under the designation, and I can see, just to let you know in the final sentence, there is note at this point that much of the adjoining land to the south and north is not zoned for residential activity, principally because of the noise contours of the airport. And so therefore a 3 metre setback, for instance, will apply on RPL's boundaries. That's activity area 8, primarily recreation, commercial recreation.
Now can you just take me on a planning map to precisely that?
So if you go to item 8 here on my submissions.
Item 8?
Tab A.
I've got a larger scale plan here.
I've got something here,
so I can believe you from these.
I've got planning map 31 on low from that one you'll see.
Planning map 31.
So this is a proposed district plan, yes.
Yeah. Proposed district plan, yeah.
So the yellow there, you see the airport designation in the middle with the two.
Yes.
Franklin Flats above in yellow, Marcus Park below in yellow.
Mm-hmm.
And off we need to go. And of course, the structure plans map the shot of the park to give the actual zone, but it might, broadly speaking, sir, if you look at the Remarkable Park, then you can see a road. There's a word Red Oak Stripe.
Yes, you see those.
Yes. There's a road there with a grey line through it.
Yes.
Activity area 8 is to the north of that. There's a little bit of a residential activity zone, area 6, joining that road, but from there back to the boundary with the airport, that's activity area 8. And there is a structure of a figure in the Remarkable Park zone which sets out what the various activity areas. So yeah, is that not sure about the question? One was over there, but that's, you have that same version, sir. It's kind of view that the sort of gear even that's the same bundle you've got there, is it?
Yes, I've got the bundle inside of the proposed district planning map index, and then I have maps 1 through to 4 of the map.
I'll try and repeat it though.
But I find those activity areas, then there's another plan that will take me to those somewhere.
Yes, if you go, that's 12.11 is the Remarkable Park zone. I'll take you the page reference, sir. So I'm assuming that electronically that can be done. Yes,
it's
12.11. I think it's 12.93, sir, but it's figure 1. Actually, the area instructor plan, the electronic version I've got here is not the right.
Figure 1, okay.
Figure 1. And so, pretty easy to serve an increase in height in that location.
Mm-hmm.
So, I take the view that the proposed modifications enable a significant increase in the scale of density and range of activities. The increase there, I've just touched on the map array discussion we had, that the map array decisions do indicate that they could, that these are the kind of activities that wouldn't be breaking the list of five words as sort of getting good with. And they're not just defined specifically the definitions of commercial activity and industrial activity. Commercial activity is very broad, in fact, it would include retail and food and beverage anyway. It's really got the whole package, and here's the final sentence which excludes various matters. And industrial activity too, quite broad, referring to manufacturing, fabricating, processing, packaging, associated storage of goods. The important thing about industrial is that is the noisy, messy activities. And so that's a significant concern from Martin's part in terms of community and what is located 3 metres from the boundary and buildings 15 metres high. So based on those definitions, the proposed modifications would or could enable, we don't have any development envelopes or indications of development, so 2.40, a 15 metre high retail office development 3 metres from the long RPL's boundary is a permissive activity. And for instance, here we have no conditions talking about the breaking up of buildings, gaps between buildings, which is something that a lot sits here and dealt with. Or under B, a service station, a panel meter, a truck depot or scrap yard with associated buildings and sheds up to 15 metres, again 3 metres from and along RPL boundary as a permitted activity. I probably should jump ahead and say, in my view, through the outline plan, it's more the nature of an informational document than one that gives rise to a thorough assessment of effects.
Do you think that the nature of the activities that you're describing that fit into the bag of industrial activities are the types of activities that would occupy that part of the airport that we're focusing on?
Well, I just don't know, because the thing that worries my clients is that if one of those activities can give a good commercial return and fall under the diversification of income, well, possibly yes, but that's the difficulty. We've got no idea what might occur and where. The airport's seeking huge range of activities anywhere else in the nation. And the difficulty, one of the difficulties with that is that this airport is basically ring-fenced by urban zones. It's not like Auckland, where you have a mix of rural and the gateway part of Auckland dealt with quite carefully, and sometimes where it does adjoin residential areas. It's a sensitive environment. But I take the point to, they might be described as fanciful or unrealistic, but I've got no idea. They're certainly, if you can establish that they are connected with the airport and ancillary to the airport, and everything, because the airport's a core business that occupies the runway there. That's, without the airport, you wouldn't have the other things. That would be the argument. These things can be issued. And I do know that for K5, those are just two examples. There are myriad development scenarios that could emerge. And the important point, I think, in that context, it's difficult to see how Mr. Kyle can say the modification in the minor. Certainly from a fixed point of view, in my submission, they completely change the development profile designations too. Mr. Kyle's assessment of effects simply confirms his general agreement with the assessment in the NLR and its modifications. The NLR document is limited to statements about what the QAC would like to do with its land. The suggestion that proposed modifications are consistent with adjoining zones and reliance on, I apologize, the title on the outline plan process to address adverse effects, or potential adverse effects, none of which are identified. In fact, there is a disarming circularity in the QAC's proposition. It is first claimed there are no adverse effects or all that minor. In fact, what it says here is that the modifications are minor. It's hard to find a statement that says the effects are minor. The NOR only describes the modifications as being minor. And the evidence claims that an outline plan can address adverse effects. All this suggests to me, at least, is the QAC doesn't know whether there will be adverse effects or the scale of them, which is entirely understandable when it appears that it has no idea what the government proposes to do, and of course, and where it proposes to do that. Exacerbating the dearth of information is Mr. Kyle's failure to acknowledge that the planning regime applying a similar development scenario on adjoining land does not a permitted activity regime, and to consider the objectives, policies and rules for those adjoining zones. Now, coming specifically to heightened setback, Sir, counsel to the QAC asserts that the summary of heightened setback attached to my synopsis is misleading, and of course I don't accept that. And the reason I don't accept that is what we endeavoured to do was compare apples to apples comparison. That is comparing permitted activities in the adjoining zones and the height of permitted activities. So that's what that table is attached to my synopsis there. That's the those are the activities, the heights that are permitted. So 2.7, now so if I walk through this in terms of the actual provisions, I can provide those to you, but these again are matters of fact. I don't think they're in dispute in terms of, I think the box submissions acknowledge the restricted discretionary regime, but importantly too, all buildings in the Franklin Flat Zones, A and B and Master Park control. So you've got master control in terms of buildings. So you don't really get a building of any height that is not activity in either of the adjoining zones. So what I've been saying is that the thrust of that submission, sir, is that it's not an apples for apples comparison. And over at page 6, I've just identified two assessment matters in the Franklin Flats B zone, which deal with the effects of dominance of buildings when viewed from state highway or the EAR or road to certain public places or roads intended to have a certain amount of amenity. And secondly, that the location design of the building, I've emphasised here, should be sufficient to remedy or mitigate any adverse effects of the proximity of the building to the boundary and neighbouring land uses, and that could be at C2. A residential activity. And the usual suspects in terms of things that affect in an urban zone is matters of control or standard. So it's completely, the problem here, I've said, it's misunderstood my statement that the zones are irrelevant. I say they're irrelevant in terms of comparison because it uses the justification for height. Because you have to jump through a whole different set of hurdles, identifying precisely the effects you have to deal with in order to use those heights. And the airport proposed none of those conditions. So that, I say they're irrelevant in terms of effect. I say they're irrelevant in terms of justifying what's proposed in designation 2. The best you can get to is comparing permitted heights with the caveat that no buildings are permitted, they're all controlled. So there's no, that reliance is completely misconceived in my submission set. So just below those quota passages, I just note here, I might make a point, that what you're dealing with in those particular matters is what commonly called EGIPX, between zones, between activity areas. And that's exactly the issue with setback and height here is the EGIPX, between the designation and the adjoining zones. So I've set out at 2.8 a number of assessment matters for industrial activity, so those are some matters for control for industrial activities in Franklin Flat B, for E1 and D. So they're here, just for your reference, but of course they're all the district plan. And then 2.9 and 2.10 here, I've just summarised some of the matters in terms of Activity Area 8, what Activity Area 8 is. 2.10, permitted activity must comply with all site and zoning standards, and the site standard for height in that area is 9 metres. The 18 metre height limit is a zoning standard, compliance with which results in a restricted discretionary activity status with various relevant assessment matters identified thereto. And I haven't gone into setbacks, but similar regimes with setbacks. If you breach, you go into the assessment matters, and I stand by that table. Reduced in my synopsis is giving an indication of setbacks. Now I acknowledge that the industrial zone for the north of the airport has no setback, there's a range. But the box of that position by assessing the effects of the uses rather than just saying, well, they do it over the road, so why can't we do it too? At 2.11, importantly, it is clear that the adjoining zones anticipated the potential for adverse environmental effects arising in the bulk and scale of buildings. There is no assumption that effects will be minor. Therefore, Mr. Cole's assertion that effects are minor, and as I say, it tends to be talking more about the modifications of minor, because the proposed heights are similar to adjoining zones is fundamentally ignored, I make the point again, it ignores the relevant activity status treated by Hans. And the assessment regime applying back to it is even relation to the middle Hans. So I just set out 2.12.176a, the matters to which there might be addressing an outline plan. And as I say, I think that that's there is an information, more in the nature of information. Make a submission, it's very difficult, I would suggest, for the council to raise issues of adverse effects in terms of immunity or bulk and location when the conditions of the designation provide for that setback or bulk, because the responsibility for requiring authority will that's for you determined as a permitted height. So it's envisaged that it would have these effects or the buildings could be of this scale and placed this close. And I'll give the loss of this, and that was very much the issue in Judge Borthwick's mind. What are the outcomes you're seeking to achieve in conditions? What are you trying to protect? And so that they have some meaning, there's something for the council to grab onto when it's setting an outline plan. So two things do I say. My position is factable to suggest that the application of section 176A might result in an examination of effects of building height akin to that applying the neighbouring land under a zoning regime. In fact, in reality, the desire is cast in relation to the height, shape and bulk of the public work project or work by the inclusion of the height and setback rules. An outline plan is principally an informational document used to establish compliance with conditions of the designation, and we have two. We've got height and setback. And of course, there's no public participation at that stage in terms of the outline plan. And the requiring authority can ignore any recommendations made by the council. And having thought about that, I tried to find a decision of a 176A outline plan going to the Environment Court. And I found one last night and it's a leaked email to me, but it's a 2006 decision in Auckland where the argument was about, and I'll find the decision soon and give it to you, was about the removal of church building, whether that came as a definition of the work. So we didn't really go into development and positioning the building, but this fundamental argument about whether it was a work and it was a heritage building. It's a Waikatori decision. But there's a top important point is that's the only time I'm aware of council taking an outline plan for the Environment Court. So that might mean that the council and providing authority reached a satisfactory position on these things, but I think it's more likely that designations are very clear about the conditions, or the council feels it has nothing to hook into to try and alter what's proposed. And that's the point I make there at 12.14. It would be difficult to see how the council could raise adverse effects on the environment in the absence of any mention of adverse effects of the designation, immunity effects, landscape effects. And the views already spread by QACG first, the effects are minor, although as noted, I make the point here that there are our own states and modifications being minor. It doesn't express a direct opinion on adverse effects. Furthermore, the council may make recommendations and so on. So that's my submission here about the outline plan too. You'll be concerned to know that I'm now going to lock this and I'm going to take you to a four-page quote, but I'll keep emphasise both that I'd like to take you to. And I'll almost say I haven't given you both decisions, but you're comfortable that I'll file them electronically so you have them in their totality, because there's the first one I talk to, and then the second one you get the actual suite of positions confirmed by the Environment Court, and you'll see. Everyone still didn't agree, and the court determined what was the appropriate set of conditions. They weren't offered up as a mediated settlement between the parties of the parties, right to the most promoted the very effort on that issue it was. So, as I mentioned in my synopsis to
just pause there for a moment, and take me to the planning map again, planning map 31, this is a good one to do. Yeah. And lot 6, I identified that somehow, I can't remember how I did it, but lot 6 is along that same area where I penciled AAA
and my friend might correct me, but approximately half, the northern half of that would be, as a rule of thumb, the northern half of that could be your age.
So it runs along that Yeah, it runs along the boundary and it comes down the side of it as well, doesn't it?
It does. Well, yeah, the final, yes, I think the first of the discussion is, the final configuration may change it to access or bus hatch roughly. As you're leading to it, it does come down for access, however the road is informed by Martin's Park and they ultimately provide access, meaning that it can come on.
So when you say half, if we look at my map 31 again, and I'm looking at drive, and I'm looking at that crosshatched road, so I'm figuring that lot 6 is about half of the yellow area between the road I've just identified and the boundary with the designation.
I think that's adequate for the purpose of our discussion. I just view that in the master plans, the airport master plans in front of you. If you don't, that's fine. But
Saying, well, I'm not precisely
sure. No, that's what I've got for the purpose of this discussion, that's about the site of Lot 6.
Right, okay.
Probably 1 kilometre along that boundary.
Alright.
So, as I say, at Nietzsche the environment court was confronted with the very issue of large buildings adjoining the RPP that ranked a very different view of Mr. Kyle. And of course, Mr. Kyle and Mr. Miskell and others were involved in that case, so we're all familiar with it. The QAC was seeking to designate land for general aviation and precinct, which would include hangar buildings, and because of the current conditions, hangar buildings can exceed 9 metres, they are not caught within that restriction. Large areas of car parking were also proposed, a developed envelope not dissimilar, and my suspicion is that development envelope not dissimilar to the scenario I identified earlier, or potentially available under this modified designation. RPL raised issues in relation to landscaping, and from paragraph 187, that's just the issue that RPL raised, but now that's summarised by the court. We head over the page. I do not accept counsel for QAC contention that this decision is not helpful. In my submission, it's relevant and instructive. It provides insight into the issues that can arise in the development of large buildings on RPL's boundaries, and more importantly, or any adjoining zone boundary for that matter. I'd like to the pipeline there, but it's development of large buildings on any boundary basically. While I've acknowledged that the Lot 6 decision concerns a specific proposal, it is difficult, at least in my view, to comprehend the inference that the QAC has less of an obligation to address effects when little or no detail of what's proposed is given, noting that we've been directed to two conflicting master plans to guide us as how development might proceed. And the 2008 master plan sewer has the general aviation precinct on the north, quite frankly, that's C zone. And the 2011 master plan has the general aviation precinct on Lot 6. So we've got two master plans showing might be land on either side, so taking up a fair bit of that land on either side for general aviation. So we don't know which way that's going. It's clearly the airport's strong preference is that it be on Lot 6. And then what land is that being available for the commercial, industrial, retail, and food and beverage? If Lot 6 fails, then that land is available by this modification for those range activities at increased height. And given the importance that I've subscribed to, and I urge you to do the same, I'll reproduce the court's analysis and reasoning in relation to landscape and visual unity in its entirety, sir. I haven't touched on the traffic issues, they are in there too, in terms of how we act, how is traffic going to move, what are the traffic impacts that you'll see in the conditions of designation that's addressed. But I don't propose to read all of this out, because that would be rather tiring, but I'll take you through the Volvic Pass, and at paragraph 183, the court said, Mr. Miskell prepared an assessment of landscape effects attached to the NOR. In it, he concluded that the potential adverse effects, landscape effects resulting from the development will be less than minor. While he did not consider the viewing population within the RPZ site to be particularly sensitive to landscape change, he recommended a buffer of grass and scrub and tree planting at the southern boundary of the NOR. As it transpires, the NOR did not include any conditions addressing the built form of the location of buildings within the proposed general aviation helicopter precinct. In his evidence-in-chief, Mr. Miskell reviewed this earlier opinion. Upon reflection, he now found the views on the north of the activity area act to be an important consideration and recommended that landscape design controls be established, in particular conditions requiring 1.2 metre high hedge, avenue planting and native beech trees within the car parks. 185, Mr. Miskell also recommended that a landscape buffer be maintained between the infrastructure and buildings on the designated land in the balance of Lot 6. And finally, that there should be thoughtful site and design of all buildings and infrastructure to create a high standard of visual amenity from public viewpoints. Interestingly, sir, the court was as concerned about the impact on people arriving at the airport, tourist destination, first time in Queenstown, durability to take in this amazing view of mountains, as it was about the impact on Marcus Park. So it's not just about what you're doing, what's happening to my client, it's conditions ensuring that the arrival experience of the airport's a pleasant one. At 186, the need for the precinct to appropriately address the environment in which it was located, in which it is to be located, only really gained traction with QAC after the QLEC non-regulatory joined the proceedings in June 2012. That is so, notwithstanding the recommendations made by RPL's landscape architect in the developments and the report prepared by the EPA. So in this case here we have the council in its regulatory capacity represented and its non-regulatory capacity requested during settings that the council come in and both capacities. So that's what that comment refers to. I propose to take you through the views and remarks of this park design other than over a page to say that said, RPL is less concerned with maintaining a view to a skyline than it is with maintaining visual connection to the surrounding mountainous landscape. Ms. McKenzie's response to that was RPL's landscape witness. So the proposed landscape design controls was that it would have limited effect in addressing the visual effect of the proposal because of its built form. Just so that I notice here at the introduction there, the court dealing with this had three landscape architects, John Miskell, Bruce McKenzie and Dr. Reed. So a lot of good, not agree with all of it, but good thorough analysis about these issues because they were considered significant. Quite, you have no idea any landscape evidence at all. Take that for what you can. Coming down now to discussion of findings at 194, we agree with Dr. Reed and Mr. McKenzie that the lack of control and the designation conditions over the form, bulk, location, and exterior appearance of buildings could unmitigate. This is a kicker, sir, create a significant adverse effect on the visual amenity of both parts of the RPZ located adjacent to the aerodrome. That finding, sir, this is where I think it brings into sharp focus the failure to consider alternatives by the QAC in this case. The Environment Court has found significant adverse effects to this, so there's the threshold for being required to consider alternatives. And that interest in the land, but if the adverse effect is significant, you have to consider alternatives. Now, that's no further assessment done because the airport claims these effects and minor. The effects we haven't modelled, we don't know what they are, but they'll be minor. Because from the start, you can get 15 metres high through a completely different measure. That's all you've got. That for me is significant. The airport within this case had experts dealing with these issues and had the judge say to them, unmitigated, building this site, there's significant adverse effect on the Martin's Park community. So, not something I would imagine would likely have gotten. At 195, while development within the RPZ, including Active Area 8, may obstruct views towards the north, and in the nature of any development, the remnant natural character of RPZ undeveloped land will be diminished. This does not detract from the relevance or significance of the views and the derived visual amenity for this zone. We find this to be the case even without assuming that any particular pattern of development will emerge in Active Area 8, such as a golf course or other recreational facilities. Then, so we move down to conditions, and at 199, the court said the conditions proposed by the QAC and QLEC regulatory, not non-regulatory, planners were not supported, and we find that is with good reason. The conditions essentially provide tools by which to address the visual and amenity effects of development, but with no objectives articulating the intended outcomes. And so then there's directions that follow, sir, for what the QAC was to go away and do, and based on the preparation of an integrated, conditions to respond to those various issues, and that was to be a concentrated process. then we come down to the overall conclusion on landscape and visual unity. And it's a case of deja vu. It says, QHD has prioritised operational requirements without giving adequate consideration to how the development of the southern precinct addresses the surrounding landscape and urban context. I'll say to you, so that's exactly what happened again with the proposed modifications. It's a significant height increase. It's a significant reduction in setback. And it's a significant increase in the range of activity that the designation expressly permits, irrespective of whether a more vehicle has them or not. Those are the significant changes. There is considerable potential for large-scale utilitarian buildings to be developed within the designation, particularly in the absence of maximum building height controls in relation to hangars. This effect, the effect of this would be to reduce the views and visual energy enjoyed, here's the point, both by persons arriving and departing from this airport and from the RPZ. The deficiencies in the management of landscape and visual unity do not reflect the importance attributed to Queenstown by the Ministry of the Environment, that it is a world-renowned tourist destination and a place of national significance. And finally, on the basis of what was put forward to it at that point, the Environment Court concluded our concerns are such that we are unable to conclude that the NRR confirmation as proposed by QAC achieves the purpose of the Act. There's part two. It doesn't meet part two as it's put forward to us. So, I'll submit to you that what the court presented in Lot 6 is actually more sophisticated and actually has some conditions than what you're being given here today. So, I'd say that analysis is very significant to RPL concerns. And equally here, what we also have here is you landscape architects did say that the northern side was less sensitive. However, the same issue, the same edge issue still arises here, and the fact of the matter is we don't really know what the impacts are. And that zone, frankly, these zones, talks quite regularly about maintaining view shafts and connections to the mountains. So you have street alignments, you have buildings, so people still are getting these views and that connection. But all of the skyline, it was the connection to the mountain. But the bottom line is we have no envelopes, we have no consideration of separation. We have no conditions about, for instance, on the other side, where the Grant Road view shaft is. So, for instance, if you've got that map, so you'll see Grant Road and Franklin Flats Zone on 39. These roads are used as view shafts, so if you wanted to preserve that connection, you're going to have to avoid a building determination of it on the designation land. So those are the kind of things that you would expect to see come through the designation. They're not there, so there's no condition. And so from those passages it can be seen that the adjoining zones were relevant, both the RPZ and proposed Trans 19, and as I say, I note at this point that Mr. Kyle has not considered the ODP at all, other than to refer or compare, if I've done correctly, the various building heights that are available there. There's no assessment of what development might occur after the area April, no assessment of what might occur at the event center or whatever else. The ODP in New Zealand isn't even mentioned under the heading planning instruments. Doesn't go there. The QAC landscape expert had initially asserted that the potential adverse landscape effects resulting from the development would be less than minor, and therefore the NRI does not include any conditions addressing built form and location of buildings. The QAC's landscape reviewed that opinion and then proper conditions that were found to be inadequate. Views to the mountains and derived visual immunity for the RPZ were found to be relevant and significant. The QAC did not offer a clear condition for council service. QAC was directed by the environment to prepare the conditions for the court's approval. And so just so they're at attachment B here, I do mention that later on, but attachment B to my submissions are the actual conditions that were ultimately approved in the final decision. You'll see the first heading is traffic and access arrangements. Over the page we get into the approved landscape and design conditions. I don't propose to take you through all of those, but you deal with outstanding natural landscapes. Landscaping achieves a high level of on-site and off-site amenity. And very importantly, over in building designs, to avoid a linear arrangement of buildings where practicable, vary roof lines, limiting the colours increasing detailing articulation, so the court thought very hard about how such large buildings would be arranged to provide the appropriate balance. And I don't think it should be at all surprising. The use of my solution is very surprising that it's not something included in this proposed modification. And I also know that IMF that the conditions initially proposed by the QAC were opposed for good reasons. An important point there is the court considered that they would not articulate intended outcomes. At G, QAC prioritised its operational requirements without giving adequate consideration to how the development addresses the surrounding landscape in the urban context. And finally, as I referred to you before, sir, the court was unable to conclude that the NLR in that state get the first of the act. And so I don't think that the paragraph 2.19, sir, I just touched on that, but that it refers to the attachment B. In my submission, each and every shortcoming identified by the Environment Court can be said to arise in relation to the proposed modifications to designation 2. However, the flaws in the analysis of evidence are more significant because I've labelled this point, Mr. Cole has not assessed the proposed modifications against the OEP as expressly required under section 17118, Roman 4. Under the section plan instruments and his evidence, paragraphs 451 to 464, he does not mention the operative district plan. I think the proposed district plan, and I'm sort of going to the importance, the significance of that is that these two zones, sir, the two that list yellow, they're not included in the review. They've been especially excluded. So for the foreseeable future, they will be in the form that they are in the operative district plan. It's, I think that's significant. And given the findings of the court in the Lot 6 proceedings, Mr. Kyle's assertion that the effects can be minor is seriously undermined, and consequently the failure to assess alternatives comes in sharp focus. Alternatives that have not even been contemplated include specific height regimes and activities for specific areas within the designation 2 land. And I play exactly because that's what I've seen in the airport, the Auckland Airport example, and I'm sure that's the case in Christchurch, where there's specific areas for activity and are range in quite a lot of mentioned. But I predict that the QAC will argue that they don't have that level of detail, even they probably get further say nor do they need to. I don't expect that, because the failure to have some level of detail prevents an assessment of effect. There's no reason why we can't have a development envelope proposed and shown with these types of setbacks and see what it does and see what Nestor thinks about it. And in fact, it's exactly what happened at Lot 6. The range, there was a plan with a bunch of buildings, and the people made it quite clear in the court that might not be how we develop as an indication of what might go there. But that is not what we're not committing to doing that. And that was a basis on which effects were assessed on an indicative scenario. Now, turning now to the Auckland Airport, the zone designation provisions for Auckland Airport provide some insight into the type of assessment conditions that might be included in a designation for a modern airport. And so I don't want to label this because you'll be much more familiar with Christchurch than I am, and I've attached you just so you know. Item D is the report of the Independent Hearings Panel to the Auckland Council on the designations for the airport. Formal decisions, the Council's notified decisions on all other aspects of the porch but designations. So we don't have a decision on that yet, that's the process, it's occurring at a slower rate. They're not far away, we don't have them yet. If you turn over to the first page, this is designation 1100, Auckland International Airport, and below that is the purpose towards the bottom of the page, and there is a list of activities, and you can see those are airport activities, you don't have general commercial food and beverage. So that's the first designation, and there's a comprehensive suite of conditions, like this airport has in terms of noise and how it manages matters and a bunch of plans. We have to get through to page 46 before you get the second designation. That's 1901. And so there you've got to either based on the runway, taxiway, and so on. So again, core aeronautical activities, repair, maintenance, surfing aircraft, and so on. And then you move through to page 51, and you've got the noise, the obstacle limitation, flow detection, and ground light restrictions. So that's what the designation does in Auckland. And that is how it's recommended to be addressed there. What I do have here is, this is a statement of evidence for Greg Osborne, who is an airport planner, and all it does is it just sets out the proposed framework and confirms what I've said at ABC, designations, overlays for noise, and objectives. I'd like to hand that up so you have that to just take you to a certain setting.
Yes.
Framework approach. It is only evidence, it's not here, but it's just to confirm the structure. And that's the 3.9, and this is the process of subscribing. So, the airport designations, but what's important is if you go over to C, the objectives, policies, and rules within the Auckland Airport precinct, which provides a full range of activities, generally excluded. It's excluding those that provide a board of designation on an overlay that occurs. So, A, resource management zoning. Now, I know the Auckland Council gets very annoyed when you call precincts sites of zones. They think they're a little important. But that's basically what it is. It's bespoke zoning, generally based on things like historical use, preserved historical uses, or topography, but they call them precincts. And so if you have that, you've got the precinct at IMA, the Auckland Airport precinct. And you'll see there's a suite of objectives and policies at pages 2 and 3. And for example, policy 3, encourage developments to achieve a high standard of amenity in the layout of buildings, car parking, access, landscape, elements, and publicly accessible areas. Policy 7, encourage subdivision and development in the gateway sub-precinct area areas to achieve a high standard of urban design and amenity and demonstrate integration with the adjoining neighbouring gateway sub-zone.
Sorry, I've just lost my face.
Oh, I'm sorry, so this is tab D, page 2, policy 3, where it's talking about a high standard of amenity.
Policy which number?
Policy 3, sir.
Policy 3.
And then policy 7, integration with adjoining gateway zone. These are examples, sir, and I do notice that policy 8A talks about confining retail activities to those required to provide convenience and shopping needs for employees. And then you've got the activity table over on page 4, and it needs to be clearly acknowledged that it's pretty permissive. A lot of things, a lot of those activities. But if you go over to page 5 at the top here, you'll see retail not complying with standards non-compliant. So at the top of page 5, second row, retail does not comply with standard 140261, non-compliant with both zones, and that standard series is at page 9. And this is the only little thing you've got, Alice. We identify retail where goods being sold are not manufactured on site, must be less than 200 square metres and combined no more than 3,000. And retail where you are manufacturing on site must not exceed the lesser of 25% gross floor area, site manufacturing or 250 metres squared. You'll see identifying sub precinct C and D for some proper consideration to the mix and where they might go and how they work in terms of an integrated package for the airport. So, yeah, and then you'll see there are what follows is 15, 16 pages of conditions relating or assessment matters relating to various activities. But most of those are controlled restricted discretion activities. So it is permissive, and I don't think any particular problem with that, but there's a suite of matters to assess against, and of course, standards developed with a view to addressing effects. So based on that, I won't go through through 2.24 and 2.526 because I think I've summarised those particular issues. And I touched on the McElroy decision again when we had that discussion. At 2.26, I do say, however, in order to even begin to assess adverse environmental effects, we would need to have some information. Realise we can't say exactly, some information about scale, mass, and location for proposed activities. Now, turning to my synopsis, and hopefully I might have clarified the factual matters for you here, sir. First of all, I acknowledge that the master plan, 2008 master plan, was appended to the lot at Karinawa. It wasn't on my Dropbox file, so I apologise, Ms. Wolf's correct about that. And I just make the point that notwithstanding the two master plans relied upon, and I only say relied upon in terms of discussions I've had with QAT through my office, the 2008 master plan and the 2011 master plan, they are inconsistent. And so I attached the extracts to my synopsis. The main point to show that one plan has the general aviation precinct on one side and another plan is on the other side. Now that's just a matter of fact, and as you know, the airport supports the proper location now. At 3.3, Council for QAC assert that the lot 6 proceedings are irrelevant and unhelpful because the proceedings are unsettled in a lot 6 case has presented different facts. They are different too, but are similar in terms of, I mean, a big building is a big building. It doesn't matter what goes in it, but to the extent of noise. But a big building is a big building from an amenity and landscape point of view. And I accept that a department store might not be as noisy as a panel beater. But in terms of amenity and connection to landscape and so on, same thing, it's a big building. But what she also says, however good in her submission, she confidently predicts that the court is expected to confirm the 60-hectare designation once QAT completes an aeronautical study in relation to obtaining approval for the works enabled by LOT 6 NOR. So in one sense it's unsettled, but a confident prediction that it's almost done and dusted now. I don't know if I agree with that, but that's what we see in the submissions. More concerning in my submission is her statement that in the present case, QAC is seeking, via its designation, to enable the opportunity to establish a range of activities commonly found at airports, so to achieve its objectives for this designation, one of which is diversification of income, it has no concept development plans in place. Which reinforces the fact we've got no idea. No one knows what's going to happen if we just want much more height and we want to get much closer to the boundary. And we want to do this additional range of commercial, so office, retail, the whole lot. The statement visibly highlights the QAT's approach, which is to say what it wants to do, why it wants to do it, call it a public work, and pay, I say, no consideration to potential adverse environmental effects. This theme emerges at paragraph 89 to 99, where Council of QAT cites and quotes the McElroy decisions. As she acknowledges, however, those decisions concern the public work at 1991, the requirements of the RMA are not addressed, there is no consideration of adverse environmental effects in those decisions. Quite understandably, it was a matter of whether that land was still being held for aviation purposes and interest in either court. Both the High Court and the Court of Appeal, I think, said even the instrument could be used as something else if that's generating income underrated the airport, or it to be used for airport purposes in the future. The current use wasn't alternative. If the airport maintained, well, we might be doing some industrial activity there, but that's not going to be happening forever. You eventually will be doing something that's aviation related. That was okay too. So it was very, very manoeuvre in that sense. I've already said I don't accept that the table is inaccurate or misleading or incomplete. I've explained that my table of heights is about mid activities. And I'll clarify it, I've said this already before, so I do not consider that comparison with surrounding zones is not necessary, and that was a statement made at paragraph 1-6. At my paragraph 2-1-C-8, I stated that comparison was largely irrelevant. The reason for this is it is not an apples with apples comparison for the reasons I've set out above. The designation is proposed to provide various kinds of activities with almost no conditions, and the surrounding zones have quite different regimes. So I made that point too. I acknowledge there is some validity to the arguments of the QAC in relation to prohibited activity status from a statutory interpretation perspective. So I accept what the QAC says. We can only do what's enabled in that designation, so the prohibited activity status rule is redundant. I think you read the Act, that's probably right. However, having said that, not all readers of the district plan are lawyers, and if a prohibited activity rule provides clarity and certainty to readers of the district plan, my view should be retained. And I think the main concern about that rule was the use of non-airport for label activities, but that was an unclear phrase. And so what I propose is it simply says any activity not expressly provided for the designation of prohibited. So you get rid of that phrase non-airport related activities. That's at my 2.4 of my synopsis there. It's not something that's at the very core of our case, but that's the balance. I think Ms. Wall's probably right about the law, but we're not lawyers that read these plans. And it's a thing that you've asked where you usually cover that really listed in the designation. Confirmation of the uplifting of designation 2, this is from the 80 more plan, is acknowledged, and we wait for clarification. That's helpful. And if the addresses, and I'm sorry if I refer to those as lost, but if 27, 29 and 31 Lucas Place are owned by the QAC, to take no issue with that plan being designated. We just weren't able to establish it, who owned it. RPL retains its concerns about the description of the inner edge. QAC have not established which document is wrong. That's the essence of our complaint here. We know there's an inconsistency between the words of the designation and a figure and a map, but we still don't know which one's wrong. And there's no reasoning to show that it is the words. If the description is right, then figures 1 and 2, which have your obstacle limitation surfaces coming out from that point, should be amended. And which would contract the OLS, so they bring the obstacle limitation surface in, and may remove some height restrictions on adjoining land. And there is no evidence establishing that the origin of the OLS needs to be 150 metres from the centre line of runway. Furthermore, sir, and Ms. Locke made submissions that the two aren't connected, or that I was missing these concepts, and so I read that carefully, and I went back to the master plan, and I found a statement where, I'm not expert on this, but this is what the Air Force Aviation Expert said about runway strip and OLS. The runway strip and its associated obstacle limitation services serve to protect the manoeuvring areas required by aircraft whilst operating on or over the aerodrome runway. The two are linked in that the OLS services originate from the edge of the runway strip. Now, that's page 23 of the 10-year master plan, which I can provide to you. But that's how Airbus describes the relationship between the two things. So, all I say there is I mentioned in my synopsis, at 3.3 that the master plan talks about so 3.2, in fact the QAC's aviation experts have confirmed in the master plan reports that the runway operates with a 150 metre wide runway strip, and I attach the two extracts from the 2023 master plan, which is actually the 2008 and the 2011 master plan. So Mr. Kyle said a minute ago that that's not how we've operated, we've relied on the 150 metres from either side of the centre line. Well, they may have in terms of limiting height and obstructions, but their planners have never relied on that in terms of use of the runway, I've seen. And also the two are linked. So if you don't need if you've got a 150 metre runway strip, and that's fine, and that's what your experts, you can bring those bands in. And so I said, look, here's the point, I don't know which one's wrong, so, and I don't think anyone's taken us to help us much on that. So that's as far as I can take it, because I don't have a witness, I don't have an expert. But what I do say to you, sir, is I don't think the QAC has established that the words are wrong. that the material suggests is right.
Now, when I've read the evidence, I couldn't find my way through that with any ratings at all, so...
I tell you, technical very quickly, it's not difficult, so I've just tried to give you some material, other reports that provide things I don't understand. Now, in this product of the terrible type of this 3.12, but what I just say here is the findings of the Environment Court, to which I refer to my synopsis, were not disturbed by the High Court. And that was in terms of whether the 300 metre wide strip under that designation, under the purpose of that designation, like I said, what Ms. Walsh says, it had a different objective. She's correct about that. But the court said that the 300 metre wide strip didn't serve, didn't meet the objective, didn't link the objective, and rejected it. And the High Court didn't disturb that. So in conclusion, sir, on the basis
this is the point you're making at your 3.2 in synopsis, where you put out the reference to
correct.
Mr. Carl, and then discussed at paragraph 138.
Correct, sir.
Alright, thank you.
So in conclusion, sir, on the basis of the above, in my submission to modification, the lawyer say this lightly, but I don't think you have any choice but to reject them because of the total paucity of information to support them. I'd urge caution in terms of receiving any proposed conditions or evidence today off the cuff to try and come up with a solution. That may not be the case, my son could be wrong, but from what I see, they must be rejected. There is almost a total absence of any proper effects or assessment of effects. And Ms. Galloway-Baker took you earlier to Ardmore and the Basin Bridge decision. Part 2 is still right on that. Designations and effects 171 is asking to look at these matters in terms of assessing effects in relation to Part 2. So effects, adverse environmental effects are right at the core of a designation. That's the starting point. I just don't know how we get to this point where we're proposing life-based significant modifications with almost no effects assessment on the different land. It's quite, I've never confronted it before. The QAP's approach, in my submission, I might be being a bit unfair here, but it's akin to the council seeking to put a wastewater treatment plant next to a sensitive urban environment and justifying the statements such as it's a public work, we want a wastewater treatment plant and other councils have a wastewater treatment plant. Those statements might be true and valid, but they do not address environmental effects.
Where do the quoted words come from?
Oh, that's my quote, sir. They're not from the document. I'm using that in the sense of making a statement. So this is a public work. We want to do this, and we're of other interest. So those are all true, but they don't reflect the news. That's my point. So those are my submissions, sir. Thank you for your patience. The attachment, I will electronically get the 2.6 decisions to you that I've referred to, and I expect that Ms. Rock will probably provide the McElroy decision for you.
I've already got
them. So, this is subject to any further clarification or questions.
Now, the attachment C in your bundle,
yes.
That already includes Mr. Osborne's
email. That's slightly different. Paragraph A, executive summary, it was just to give you some comfort that what you're looking at is almost confirmed.
Understood.
It is the same statement tonight. What he said that item A, the relevant provisions have mostly been agreed with all the council and most others and are required to during mediation, and I support them. So just to give you an indication that what you see here for the airport is not confirmed. I don't believe there are any appeals on the precinct, on the airport being for the precinct, but the council still may have taken the appeals and working through them. But that there was at least a degree of agreement to what I would catch.
Okay.
There were hearings on those, sir, as I say. I I might, if any determinant I can try and find out today to whether the airport and airport precinct have been appealed. There are about 50 or 60 appeals, but they're clustered into mainly the residential and density and rural issues, and the last report I got was that the Auckland Airport precinct hadn't been appealed. And I can try and confirm that on the Environment Court website or with the council, if that's this. But even having said that, sir, I wouldn't have thought an appeal, if there is one, would be seeking to revert to no conditions, it would probably be a disagreement looking for more.
Yeah, just refining the number,
I think. That's right. So thank you for pointing out, sir, I've been taken to that. I guess what I answer, I completely understand the difficult position my submission put you in. But of course that's not of my client's doing. And as a decision maker, it'd be very difficult for you that if you're lacking information, something you're grappling with, I understand, I don't have knowledge of it, that the people before me talking about noise and light aircraft operations and lacking information. That's an issue that the QAC is making in this situation.
What we might do, I think, is we'll take a pause for the lunch break now. I've got a number of queries and questions I scribbled out on your synopsis. I think many of them we've already talked about already on the way through. But I want, I think, just to have a conversation with you about some of the material and Ms. Holden's report,
yes.
And maybe just check with you some particular provisions in Ms. Watts' evidence that maybe that we're doubling up. But I've written notes and I'd rather do that so I've got it in my mind. then following lunch, we've got lunch scheduled between 12:40 on the fiddle lift through to about 1:30. Was there another solicitor who was wanting to come along?
Yes, David
Sherman. And what time?
1:30.
And he wasn't for very long, was he, from memory?
Okay.
10 minutes. And then following that, we would go to Queenstown Airport for the balance of the day. So we've got legal submissions in this car. Right. Okay, so that's the plan. So let's take a break now. Through to 1:30, and I'll come back and deal with the questions first before we go to Mr. Durant.
Thanks, sir.